So, tell us what you're gonna talk about.
Oh, right. So this, I've been talking about this for a few weeks. I am doing a brief talk at Hope College at the Front Porch Republic annual meeting. And that's this Saturday coming up, but when you hear this, it will have already happened. So,
Like a prophecy
I know. It's like, it
from
was
the
the
future.
future.
Greetings in the future.
Future, future, future.
So where's Hope College?
It's in Holland, Michigan. It's a beautiful little city, by the way. It's really, really gorgeous.
What kind of a school is this?
Hope College is a Christian school, but I use that term lightly because it's a pretty, I think it's reform. I think it's a reform college.
Okay.
And it's been there a long time. It's not one of these sort of new evangelical colleges of the last 40 years or 50 years. It's an established college from the Reformed tradition.
It's not like a for-profit Davenport University kind of.
No. One of the organizers is a professor there,
Yeah.
and he's kind of old school.
Okay, so what can you tell us about Front Porch Republic, though?
Front Porch Republic, their tagline is Place, Limits, and Liberty. Meaning they care about localism, and their keynote speaker this year, you'll be glad to know,
Yeah.
is Chuck Morone talking about placemaking, because places are critical to be. You need, if it's not a real place, if it's just an also-ran, strip mall, whatever it is, people don't love that. They don't commit to that. They don't invest in that. And I mean that in every sense of the word, investment. Limits. We live in a finite world. There are limits to what can be done and how it can be done.
Yep.
And liberty, which seems like it's in contrast or in tension with limits, right?
Yeah.
But it makes intuitive sense to me because, as a Catholic, whenever we talk about human rights, we always temper those rights with responsibilities.
Sure.
And if you have a right to,
Right.
you also have a responsibility that's associated with that right.
Yeah.
So, having limits actually gives us a certain kind of freedom,
Sure.
right, to explore all we want when inside those boundaries.
Yeah, we know Chuck, and I first heard him speak in Saginaw, actually. He gave a talk there, and I really enjoyed his talk. But yeah, so what's you have a title?
I have a title. The title of the conference is Localism and the Professions. And I didn't give my talk a title because I'm still, I've been asked to speak and to write several things recently, and I'm still trying to figure out why. I'm like, you've met me,
Well, I know why,
right?
but yeah, you need to figure out for yourself why.
So anyway, there's a certain comedy to it, but they want me to give a brief talk, and they know that I am a practicer of the oldest profession.
Motherhood. Yeah.
So I'll
And you're
start.
taking the baby with you.
I'm taking the baby with me because it's what I do.
Yep. Hey, can you when you go up to give the talk, do you think you can put her in the backpack?
I was planning to.
Backpack or the front carrier?
Well, I think I'm gonna go with where she's happy.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have both with me, and I'm gonna
See
do what she
what she
where
likes.
she's comfortable.
How
Right.
she's feeling.
Right, because it's what I do.
Yeah, this is our newest baby, Eleanor.
And so she'll be on me somewhere in some way. She'll be on my back or in my pouch.
7 months?
Eight. She just turned
Eight
8 months. See, I
months.
told you we needed to sing her happy birthday,
Oh, yeah,
right?
yeah.
So it was the first month we didn't sing her happy birthday. Now we can't remember how
That's
old
right. I
she
kept
is.
thinking February, but no, we moved in February. She was born in January.
January, right?
Right, okay.
So yes, Ellie Nelly will be with me, and I'm going to give a talk about motherhood and localism.
Okay, cool. So do you want to do a dry run? Like, do you just want pretend we're the audience?
Yeah, I'm going to pretend you're the audience, and I'll just give my talk. And it'll be my dry run, and I can... And so, you guys, you're my guinea pigs. I'm going to work out my kinks here.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how we're doing this.
So I won't interrupt you, but move your mic up just a bit.
Okay.
Edit this out. Don't listen. This is going to make a lot of noise.
No cursing. This is a no cursing zone.
There you go.
Is that better? Okay.
Yeah, try that.
All right. I'll try that.
So it's a little awkward because I stand to record and yeah. Grace sits and
hold a baby. I have to do this.
Right. And I try to get our mics so they're... Give us roughly the same volume. Anyway, I'll stop interrupting.
All that said. Okay, so good evening. I'm assuming I was invited to speak because I'm a practitioner of the oldest profession, which is parenthood, which, you know, I've always been confused. I've always been like... not understood why people talk about prostitution as the oldest profession, because, you know, where did the prostitutes come from? Did they just like spring fully formed from a John subconscious? That's never made sense to me. But parenthood, I've always thought of parenthood as the oldest profession, the necessary profession, the work that has to be done for society to continue. I'm going to talk about motherhood because I'm a mother and not a father. And not that fatherhood is not heroic, necessary, and sacrificial. I'm just want to talk about what I know and what I'm familiar with. And I think there are a few lessons that I've learned. I'm going to talk about, give you a story. I'm going to talk about what I didn't know about motherhood. But the bulk of what I have to say is really why I think it matters and why I think it has anything to do with localism. And lastly, I want to clarify anyone who might think that my thoughts about mothering are in any way a screed against women somehow, or like some kind of, you know, anti-feminist rant or anti-woman rant. So that said, I'll start with a story. I love to tell stories, especially about my dad, because my dad was a great character and a great man. And this story, some of you may have heard, so don't ruin the punchline if you already know it. It's the story about when I decided to apply to college. I wanted to be a nuclear chemist, and I wanted to apply to Annapolis. And my teenage self sat down with my dad and said, "Okay, Dad, so I'm filling out this. I need a recommendation. Can you ask a friend of yours to write a recommendation for me so I can get into Annapolis?" And he said, "You know, I don't think the Navy is a good place for a woman." And with that right there, I was just kind of apoplectic. You know, I was outraged and could barely... through my rage, hear anything else he said. But I do recall him saying, "I think that you should apply to culinary school because you would make an excellent wife and mother." And my teenage self was just, like, I just melted down, you know, I just fell apart with rage and angst and anger. Like, you know, how could you, you know, you've always been my greatest supporter. What do you even mean? Right? And so I applied a variety of places. I ended up going to state school. I'm still glad that I went to state school. And then I came out to Michigan to go to graduate school and study epidemiology. Because, you know, you grow and you change and you look into new things and try to study other things. And then once I got to graduate school, I actually just dropped out of school to... wait for it, raise children. And the prophecy or the foresight of my father's words, the wisdom of what he had to say, was not yet apparent to me. It would be another 10, almost 12 years before I put together what he was saying. I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I was actually poring over catalogs, course catalogs for culinary school. And as children were gathered around my feet, and at that moment, I had not so much an epiphany, but like an out-of-body experience, where suddenly I was there in the room with my teenage self, and I was like screaming at myself, "You fool, listen to him, you know nothing." And it all hit me. You know, how have I wasted all these years? I could have just gone to culinary school. I would have been so much happier. My father, who knew me then and understood my vocation then better than I understood my vocation for myself at the time, was really trying to carefully tell me that not so much women aren't entitled to serve in the military, but that, you know, the Navy's not exactly a safe place for women. And as my parents often are, he was right. And that there was no way I was going to work in academia. There's no way I had the temperament for the corporate world. And really, my gifts were in family life. And that was something that I should pursue and embrace. Now, what I did know about motherhood as a young person is what I feel or find a lot of people don't know about motherhood and being a full-time parent. It's actually work. I mean, there's this sort of myth and this sort of joke that stay-at-home moms will tell each other about how they just ate bonbons and watched soap operas all day. Because it was, you know, that's all there is to do. There's nothing to do. It's work. It's real work. And if you're not really acquainted with what the work is, ask a mother. But just in brief, it's not exactly housekeeping, but homemaking, if that distinction makes sense. That it's much more about caring for people, meeting their needs on demand, 24/7, and less about the details. It's about the work of caregiving, where your brain is on all the time to solve problems and anticipate problems and deal with emergencies before they get to be serious emergencies. And that's real work. So I'm not going to try to convince you of how it's a job or how much work it is. I'm sure a lot of parents here already know and don't need an explanation of that. But rather, I think this matters and is actually a critical fact and reality, because things about parenthood have changed, and motherhood in particular, have changed radically over the last 40 years, 50 years. And the big shift that we see is that women have entered the workforce in huge numbers, and not just women in general, but like specifically women who would have been at home. How can I explain this? Before the 60s, poor women always worked. Women of a certain social class always worked. That's never been in dispute. They were housekeepers, they were cleaners, they were babysitters, they were nannies. They've always had jobs. They were cooks. But above that class, you worked part-time or you didn't work at all. And a little further up, you would actually hire the poorer women to work, and so on. But starting in the late 60s, mid-70s, by droves, women from working class and middle class women started leaving home and working. They started getting educations and working outside the home in numbers we haven't seen before, and much more than part-time, full-time. And that's changed the shape of our neighborhoods and our communities and our places in ways it's hard for me to imagine we didn't fully anticipate. But I think we didn't really grasp how devastating this shift would be. Yeah. Am I talking too loud? Okay. Okay. So this shift has led to three main things. A really radical change in how we raise children, what we expect to happen in the raising of children. It's changed how we eat, and it's actually changed how we do business. So, starting with children, I mean, yes, mothers aren't home to raise their children, but it's more than that. Because if you think about it, once a child was, say, 4 or 5 years old, they went to kindergarten and first grade, and they were out of the home most of the day, at least half the day anyway. So women could have worked, and some did, during that period. What's really, really changed is that women are working full-time from the time their infants can be left with someone else. And that was kind of sort of unheard of, unless you were really quite poor and couldn't afford otherwise. That's a huge shift. And what that's led to is the expectation that your children will be supervised by a qualified adult 100% of the time. That's the end outcome of this shift. Previously, our neighborhoods were full of women watching their children during the day. They were not ghost towns. They weren't empty, dangerous, scary places. I mean, any of us who were running around loose and fancy free in the 70s as children know there were elderly women, grandmothers and mothers inside the houses in our neighborhoods if we needed something. And maybe a few of them worked outside the home, but there were several people in the buildings in our neighborhoods that could help us out if we needed help and were eyes on the streets, as Jane Jacobs likes to talk about, who could see us and recognize us and help keep us safe. Intuitively, we know that all those houses and all those suburbs are empty during the day. And if there's a child wandering around, it's moved us into this space where we see that as a threat and a danger, and frankly, irresponsible, that a child should be left unattended during the day in these places that are bereft of the women who used to care for them and the people in them. I think another part of this is that because women are not in our neighborhoods anymore as mothers, we find that the casual care of an elderly parent or aunt or uncle or relative of some kind is a lot harder to negotiate. What might have been an informal arrangement within your own home or even within your neighborhood where you could rely on one or two other people to just check on mom or dad or Aunt Matilda once or twice a day. Those people aren't there anymore to provide that safeguard. And so still more people that would have been in the neighborhood 40 years ago have moved out of the neighborhood. It's also changed how we eat. Because now, even as a stay-at-home parent, it is hard to prepare 3 meals a day, 5, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. So folks who have two parents working full-time aren't going to stop and process vegetables for an hour before they ever start making a meal. And we've seen a huge shift in the way, in the types of food we eat, the ways we prepare them, and who we buy them from. And those shifts aren't trivial. They've damaged our health and our well-being in a variety of ways, but even more than that. And I feel like this is actually the spiritual aspect that is really counts, that really sort of makes it so sad, is people don't sit down and say grace and look each other in the eye over a fast food hamburger. They eat that behind the steering wheel on their way home, on their way to do other things. And the simple act, even if it is a fast food meal, whatever the food might be, because sometimes it has to be fast food in my house too, of sitting down with each other, looking each other in the eye, and sharing a meal and reflecting on your day, that touchstone has evaporated for so many people. And it's more emblematic than it is causal. It's an emblem of how we can't afford the time or the money or the dedication, frankly, to buy the food, chop the food, process the food, prepare the food, serve the food, clean up after the food, store the food, and make sure it gets packed for lunch the next day. It happens, but it's families that can afford that time where that happens. And the share of families that can afford that time has grown smaller and smaller with each passing decade. And so our food system transforms even more to serve people who can't afford the time to cook, who can't afford the cost of the food to cook. And I have to wonder if that's exactly an accident, if that's not really about commodifying our food resources to the point where maybe we don't have that many choices about the kind of food we want to eat and the kind of meals we want to share and the kind of food system we want to inhabit. How we do business. I know it seems like we live in this startup culture where everyone's doing startups every time you turn around. They got a Kickstarter, they got an Indiegogo, and things are, everyone's hustling. The actual fact is that the number of startup businesses are at an all-time low over the last 40 years. They're at the lowest point in 2016 that they were in the entire 40 years before that. And it's actually been a fairly steady decline from a zenith in about 1976 of startup businesses, mom-and-pop businesses, and that decline, I think, is really directly related to the absence of a stay-at-home parent. Because the freedom to start a business, the flexibility to start a business, is really attached to having someone providing the labor full time to manage a household, a homemaker, not a housekeeper, right? Someone making the home that is the place you spring from to do the work you might dream of doing or aspire to do, or just think you want the freedom to do. That freedom is less available without a support system at home, without a support system in the neighborhood, without people on the street to come in and buy your product. And yes, the market's changed very much. We've got all kinds of things and all kinds of ways to buy things that we didn't have in 1976. And this is a correlation, not necessarily a causation. You don't want to confuse them. But if you look at the nature of people who are starting businesses, it is people from the same segment of society who can afford to have a parent at home. And again, if you look at the people who are eating their meals together, they're the people in the same segment of society who can afford to have a parent at home. And if we want a counterexample to how children are raised and what it looks like, we can look to Japan. In Japan, children wander freely from the time they're about 5 years old. I mean, five. Your parents give you some money, a little bag, you walk yourself to school, and you pick up groceries on the way home when you're 5 years old in Japan. It's an expectation. Japan also has, I think, the largest number of stay-at-home mothers in the industrialized world. And you would think Japanese women are so well-educated and so this and so that, and why do they choose to stay home? There's actually, there's a structural incentive in Japan. In, I think it was 1 million yen That's the benchmark. If you make less than 1,000,000 yen, you don't have to pay certain taxes on it. Like most of the taxes you would have to pay on your income, you don't pay if it's under a certain amount. Over that amount, you pay, you know, all the various taxes into the social welfare system and et cetera. So if your spouse makes enough money, you have absolutely no incentive to make more than 1,000,000 yen. Your incentive is to maybe have a part-time job and take a little pocket money, but largely, it's much more valuable to you to stay home with your children, to possibly make a little pocket money, and do the work, the labor that's needed, not just for a home, because this is not just about your own homemaking. It's about the presence in the community that makes the community a place and a community. And the people that provide the fabric of a neighborhood during its waking hours. And where this is more of a norm in Japan, you see that children, very young children, are expected to be out in the world. They're expected, you know, because they have communities that have people in them during the day. They're not all in an office somewhere. So the idea that a child might be wandering free isn't bizarre or uncomfortable or even dangerous or criminal. It's a norm. So I don't want to imply that these correlations are causations, but when you do look at where it's still true that children run free and walk about and have independence in the community, it's communities where there are stay-at-home mothers. When you look at communities that do eat at home and do have access to local food and access, because it's not just about the local food being there, it's the ability to use it and do have access to healthy food systems. It's these communities that have women at home to prepare the food, women at home to think about this and go get the food. And when you think about the sector of society that's really engaged in startups and startup culture, it's the same sector of society that can afford to have a spouse at home. So there's a very real thing that we lose when we lose full-time parents who do that job exclusively. And I kind of hinted at this, the policy nature in the policy aspect of how this works. Because I don't want this to be interpreted or be seen as some kind of screed. Those awful women leaving home to get jobs. So selfish. Abandoning their children to the school system. Because this isn't exactly a choice for a lot of women. Just like poor women have always worked because they didn't really have a choice in the matter. They don't love their children less. They didn't have a choice in the matter. More women work because more women have to. I think we've all seen the numbers. I think we all know the evidence that you can't raise a family on a single minimum wage income. That's actually comical to even think of, trying to raise a family on a single minimum wage income. Can't even afford a home or to rent an apartment. So the further you go on the income scale, the less it's necessary. But you got to go pretty high up on the income scale before it's not necessary to have some kind of work, probably even full-time paid work, just to maintain a family with one or two children at all. And that's not some decision that women made, that we would now just have no money to raise families with. And wouldn't it be fun to go get a second job in our family? Those are policy decisions. Just like Japan's policy that's pro-family and encourages women to stay home because, you know, life is easier that way. We can have policy that is pro-family and encourages parents to care for their children and their families and their neighborhoods. These things don't happen in a vacuum. I'm not sure how we can have places that thrive and flourish without the women that animate them. And there should be limits on what we will sell our labor to the marketplace for, and what we'll sell people to the workplace for. And if I'm not free to be a mother, I'm not really free. And my community is not everything it could be. I think that's all I have to say. How long was that?
I'm not entirely sure, because I wasn't counting how many minutes of sort of introductory babble we had. Oh, but okay. I can tell you in a bit.
Sure.
I'll get it transferred over to the other computer. Yeah. I'll let you know.
Okay. So there's some bumps, some kinks.
Okay.
Make some notes here.
Was that helpful to give it to, you know, give your talk to a puppy?
Talk to the puppy.
Say it to the puppy.
I think it was.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was. So did you...
I thought it was good. I thought they were good points. I've heard much of your thinking on these subjects before. So,
right, so it's not news to you.
No, but it's good to hear it together.
I hope it's not news to most of my friends. But.
No. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll piece that together. We'll get something out, and I'll release it on Sunday.
Sounds good.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Take care.
Good night. Oh, smack the microphone, because that's good. That's always fun.